grind.
Alright, where are you going? Here, okay?
Grind.
Oh my god. Not coming in, I figured it, man.
Good job, buddy.
The Hunt for Answers. The Ugly Pike Podcast.
Hey guys and girls. Hope you enjoyed part one, Steve and Danny Herbeck. Part two, a disclaimer, there's a little bit of choppiness with Steve's audio, but the content, his wisdom, and the discussion was just too great for us to scrap, so we cleaned it up as best as we could, and we hope you enjoy it.
Today's episode is brought to you by Canada's only specialized pike and muskie shop, Izoco. Head over to izocofishing.com and check out all of the amazing hand-picked, top-quality gear they have to offer. This episode is also proudly brought to you by Angling Sports, based in London, Ontario, and serving customers throughout Canada and the northern U.S. With over 30 years of unmatched angler support, they offer top-tier fishing products catering to every skill level. Explore their offerings at anglingsports.ca and gear up for an unparalleled fishing experience. All right, welcome back to the Ugly Pike Podcast on the Outdoor Journal Radio Podcast Network. Guys, girls, if you have not already downloaded part one of our amazing discussion with legendary muskie anglers, father-son duo, Danny and Steve Herbeck, go ahead and download episode 175 now and get yourself caught up. Let's dive deeper into the intricacies of landing monster muskie on Eagle Lake in part two.
Speaking of, visual fishing, I'll never forget, Steve, when I met you, it was probably around 2014, 2015, and I was up there with my cousins. We were doing a walleye slash muskie trip, so it shows you how not serious we were yet about muskie fishing. But I'd heard of you, and I said to Julian, I said, I know Herbie's in big demand, but I'd really love to go out with him. And you were nice enough to take me and another gentleman out after dinner. And we went into the West Arm. And I remember we stopped at a spot, and it seemed like we were kind of in the middle of the water. And there was nothing around us. And I said to you, why have we stopped here? Like, I don't see anything. And you said, I wonder if you know the spot. You said to me, there's a 70-foot rock ledge right underneath us that runs for 70 feet. And, that was something I'm not focused. I'm not familiar with the waterway. And of course you were. So we had some really big fish follow us there. We didn't get anything to strike, but we had some very big fish follow
us. Probably right on the edge.
It goes again to the importance of a guy, but.
We were probably on the edge of a 70-foot basin, casting. Probably the boat was in 30 to 50 feet of water, and we were casting up to somewhere like what Danny was talking, 15 to 30 feet. You know what I mean? So, and then that clear water, the clearer the water, I think, the farther away from structure you need to be to cover that secondary break. I think in clear water, the faster you need to fish, because the fish in clear water are more sight orientated and they chase. So, and you can fish it faster, So that's how I normally fish that section of the lake, the trout waters that we were on. And of course we went there at what I thought would be a better time of, you were probably up there in July or August, right?
Yeah.
The evening, right. We went up there to try to give us a little bit of an advantage in the clear water. But, so that's a perfect example of fishing structures farther and deeper than in the dirty sections of the lake.
Right.
Steve and Danny, when I was there in September, and I think Steve, you told me this, you better be good at the boat. All of the fish I contacted, all the fish I caught was based on a figure eight. Nothing was caught out on the water except pike. Is that consistent at the opening of the season as well? Is that something that's just consistent all year on Eagle Lake, or that was just like a time of the year thing? Or so basically an opening season, is that something that the anglers need to know that the majority of their strikes will be at the boat, they should be ready for figure eighting, or it's 50-50 at that time of year?
I think a lot of it depends on the type of bait you're throwing. You know what I mean? You know, obviously, like your straight retrieving baits, like your bucktails, your topwaters, that type of stuff, the higher your odds are going to be of converting that fish at the boat, just because when muskies are, you know, following a bait or looking to eat a bait, they're looking for a direction change, right? That's the trigger for a muskie to eat. So, I mean, if you're throwing, you know, like your glider baits and your jerk baits, that type of stuff, your odds of getting a fish to bite out on the cast are greater. Not to say that, you know, you can't catch them at the boat too. But, I mean, I would say through and through throughout the year, I mean, you have just as good a chance of catching a fish on Eagle boat side as you do out on the cast. Now in the fall, that changes a little bit. I mean, they're geared significantly more toward eating. So, I mean, you see, you know, a lot more, you know, out on the cast bites and that type of stuff. But that type of year too, we're also throwing more erratic style jerk baits, rubber baits, that type of stuff to trigger the bite out on the cast. But I mean, I would say as a whole, a lot of what you were seeing and how you were catching fish at the boat has a lot to do with the type of bait you're throwing, right?
Sure. Mostly spinners, yeah, that I was throwing.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the reason those fish are following that bait and they're biting it at the boat is just because it's a direction change and a speed change. Now, there are things you can do, you know, to try and set yourself up to get that fish to bite out on the cast prior to getting to the boat. You know, like simple things like speed changes, moving your rod left and right to try and, you know, create a direction change on a bucktail. You know, like a lot of times I get in the habit of, you know, everybody gets in the habit, throw a bucktail, wind it in, do an oval at the boat, pick it up, throw it out. Yes. Does that work? Yeah. But there are some things you can do when throwing a bucktail to try and, you know, up your odds, obviously. Right. So, you know, I just in the habit of it now. I throw the bucktail out, I'm reeling it in. You know, about halfway back, I give it 3-4 pumps of the reel handle a little bit faster, try and get that speed change. And then as I'm seeing that bucktail come to the boat and I'm out 15 or 20 feet from the boat, I'll move my rod to the left 3-4 feet. As I'm winding, reel my rod to the right 3-4 feet and get that bait to kind of do a direction change prior to getting into the oval. And a lot of times you can get those fish to eat out on the cast.
Nice. That's a good tip.
Yeah.
It's just something that, you know, you have to do.
What Danny was saying.
You just discipline yourself to do it every cast. And then it becomes human nature, like doing the oval, right?
Yeah, Chris, you know, like when you guys were up there, that was like 10, 15 years ago. You know, since then, you know, when you're out there every day and you're seeing all these big fish and they're chasing and stuff like that, it's becoming an ever evolving deal for us to try and figure out how to catch them. It's just, I mean, that's just the way it's been. And things have changed quite a bit in the last 10 or 15 years. And like what Danny's saying, no matter what kind of bait, you try and create triggers before it gets to the boat. You know what I'm saying? And then sometimes you still have to convert them at the boat. The longer rods, more disciplined figure eights. You know, the forward-facing sonar showed us how many fish actually follow deep that we never even see. So because we learned that, we now do bigger, deeper, more thorough figure eights, even though we don't see a fish. I also think that, you know, it's even more important when fish are kind of off moon phases, off feeding. Sometimes you'll go through a stretch where the fish just aren't biting really good. Well, that's when they chase more. because they're like a retriever. You throw a stick, they got to chase it. But those are the fish that you really got to use triggers and or catch at the boat. And when the bite is on, when you got favorable wind, you got northwesterlies, westerlies, you got fronts coming in, you got moon phase, you got right at dark, and the fish are more apt to be feeding, you catch more fish percentage-wise out than you would when they're not. So, you know, the more you see fish chasing versus striking out, the more you have to mentally condition yourself to try and create triggers regardless of the kind of bait that you're using. Like what Danny was talking about with the bucktails, pulsating or swinging your rod tips right or left, increased speeds, stuff like that. That's why the rubber baits work so good too. Baits that you can count down because they're making a climb up to the boat after a fish has been followed. And the climb to the boat is an automatic trigger, an escape type of thing that bait fish would try to do. So that creates bites before the figure eight. So the more, like I said, the more the fish are actually feeding, the more you notice the percentages of bites out, regardless if you're creating triggers or not, you know, seem to happen. And when the bite is off, in between moon phases, hot, flat, sunny weather, things like that, that's when you got to really concentrate on trying
You know what, Steve, I always bring, when I'm, especially with blades, I always do a directional change as soon as I see my bait in the water and I take it out far and wide. And I learned that from you. You did a seminar at the lodge when I was there one time. And you said, as soon as you see your bucktail coming in, start bringing it out wide so that you can get a good smooth sweep into your figure eight or oval, as I've started doing it. I don't know if you had said that before or whatever, but I find that I'm doing that directional change. Like I'm not so much with bucktails zigging and zagging and making it variable because I don't want that blade to stop. But I definitely sweep it out as wide as I can, as soon as I can, so I get a good circular, wide, smooth figure eight. Are you still – has that changed for you, or are you still doing it that way with your figure eights?
Yeah, the longer rods, especially, you know, like I try to teach people to start sweeping the rods when there still might be 15 feet of line out. But you, with a longer rod, you start sweeping your rod, increasing the speed of your retrieve, and that encompassing combining the big sweep of the rod and reeling fast at the same time, it creates a great big turn rather than the old-fashioned L that we were taught for the last 40 years. Bring a bait into the boat, wait till you see a fish. If there's a fish, you do an L turn.
There's no doubt.
Yeah, you catch some fish doing that. But no only the really ahead, hot, stupid ones, you know what I mean?
Well, I was just going to say, I think what they're both talking about just
fish
speaks to how
its speed
focused
and
you
goes
really
into
need to be
your,
every cast.
Your
you
turns
can't take
for
any
you.
Cast for granted. You have to really
without consciously
focus yourself
realizing
and tune
it,
and find that rhythm where you
really makes a big difference in the number of fish that you convert
on
that first and second turn of whether you're doing a figure eight or an old.
Trying all these kind of little subtle changes to trigger strikes, as Steve and both Steve and Danny mentioned. So I think those are great. That's a great analysis of you know, just retrieving and how to maybe trigger strikes on those changes. But I just wanted to go back, Frank. Steve, you mentioned something about the front facing sonar and how that affected your kind of depth in your figure eight, whatnot, but just on a broader level or a broader discussion, how much of a game changer has that been for you? Because when we were there and we spoke to you, that wasn't even on the market. So now, like between you and Danny, how important is that in your arsenal in terms of accessing fish, or is it something that you just you don't use, or it's integral? Because I know it's a bit controversial depending on how it's used.
No. Well, I think it's very controversial how some people are using it. Danny and I, and I'll let Danny go into it because he's a real wizard at it. I use it quite a bit. I use it more for learning about what fish are doing. Fishing, using it as I'm fishing. I don't go use it like some of these, like the controversy is looking for fish out over open water and making 20, 30 casts a day. That's not how I use it. I don't believe that's how Danny uses it either. But it has certainly taught me how to know where the edges of structures are so people aren't snagging all the time. It tells me when a fish is what fish are doing, if they're out off the break or if they're up on the edge.
Yeah, I mean, the whole forward-facing like sonar thing, I'll use it that way, and I don't use it
all day, every day.
You know, I'm really torn with it, and it structures. Really,
I'll let Danny go into that because he's a real wizard at it,
and he's very conservative with it,
using it just you know,
but like Steve was saying, I use it more as a day-to-day tool. To gather,
controversy is
to learn, to find new structure, to see how the structure lays. You know, I use it even to help my clients work baits. You know, like I can interpret what their rod is doing and what the bait is doing off the screen, right? So say, you know, we're fishing one of those deep rock structures, you know, 15 to 20 feet. Mm-hmm. I can watch the guy's bait and say, okay, you need to slow it down for me. You're only 6 feet down. I need you down 10 feet. So now he knows to slow his retrieve, slow his reel handle, his reeling down to get that bait in that effective zone. You know, and like the amount of structure that you can find using it that you would never ever realize that on like, you know, 2D sonar looks minuscule. But you see it on like forward facing sonar where there's actually like one rock out in the middle of a mud bay and there's a muskie sitting next to it. Right. So now, you know, okay, this is a spot that I can fish. It might only take 5 or 6 casts. Right. Following weed edges, you know, you can really learn the ins and outs of the weed edges and precisely stay, you know, 30 feet off that weed edge every time you run it. You know, and another thing I started doing with it too was trolling, watching my baits trolling, pointed it backwards and watching the baits and keeping my baits in that effective zone and seeing how the fish would interact with the bait, knowing if I was going too fast or too slow, or if I needed a bait change type of deal. It's an invaluable tool, and as a guide, I feel like, you know, you have to have it. Now the whole, you know, actively hunting fish down and casting at them, I'm really torn on. You know, to each his own, I guess, how you want to use it. But I use it for, like as Steve said, more as to gain intel to conventionally musky fish effectively. It just streamlines the whole process.
Yeah, there's no question for me, Danny. Like you mentioned, like what I like to use it for, and I don't have it on my boat, but one of the boats I fish on does, and we've never once pointed it forward. We love to troll, and we love to watch our baits. So you get a really good sense of the dive curve. And that's like, if you're a hardcore troller, that is essential. Now you can always go to the bait maker and ask about the dive curve, but there's, as you guys know, there's lots of variables. What kind of line are you using? The speed of the boat? How are your rods angled? And you know what? You throw that dive curve off, that out of the box dive curve off 2 feet, And that is the difference between, you know, snag or just, you know, not getting the bait where you want it. If you're dissecting the water column and you're in 25 feet or, you know, call it 20 feet and 15 feet isn't working for you, sometimes 19 feet is what you need. You need to, you know, put that bait right in front of the fish's nose. And I found that to be tremendous. But something you guys said earlier really piqued my interest. I think, Steve, you said it. And that was like, we've changed our figure eights because this sort of imaging has allowed us to see when we're being followed by fish that are deeper. I'm wondering, Steve, with your long and illustrious career, what do you think the amount of follows that you were missing was? Like, in other words, how much do you think you were missing before that technology? Like, is it super, or were you just blown away by how many fish are actually following you, or what does that look like for you?
Again, I think it has something to do with the activity levels of the fish, the clarity of the water, how much chaos is going on, how rough and windy, how well you can see in the water. But yes, it blew my mind how many fish would turn away 20, 30 feet out. Some people can say, well, you know, it's because of the forward facing beam and stuff like that. Well, these are fish that haven't been beamed. You know what I'm saying? Or they aren't fish like in the northern Minnesota lakes that are being harassed every day by forward facing sonar. So, I mean, I think that's just the way it's always been. I think we were probably, you know, if the fish are really hot moving, you probably see a major portion of them when they're kind of off, and particularly where they could see a long distance. I've seen fish in clear water, like up on the Western Arm, that I could actually was able to see be 20, 30 feet away following a bait 10 feet below the bait. And yet it's only because they know that they can catch it.
Steve, would you change your bait for that format?
I've seen them make a move from those kind of distances and grab a bait. So, you know, if you don't have that clarity, how many are we not seeing? And the forward facing sonar showed me it's quite a few.
You know,
one thing it does too is if a fish does follow in
from it too,
that you can see and turns off
from it too
after
some
a couple
days,
turns. And, you know, at least if you click look for it, you can at least see what direction it went to try and make at least one good
spot,
throwback
they go
cast
back to
at,
the spot.
You know what I'm saying?
I would say 95% of the time,
but I'd
once
say,
you move that muskie off of that spot, it goes
out
into open water.
What I found is you don't have a lot of time.
You pulled him off the couch, and now he's back on
the
road.
You don't really have that kind of time.
He's looking for another spot.
You know what I'm saying? If you got somebody else on the boat,
do they actually turn back around and swim right back up to the rock bar or the reed bed after you pull them out? And so the whole idea of, you know, seeing a fish and then turning around and fishing the spot again, we're going to catch him this time. Oh, we didn't see him. He didn't like our baits, or he didn't move. No, the fish wasn't there. It's gone. Now, not to say that fish isn't going to go out in the open water 200-300 yards, hang out. And then when conditions change again, it'll slide back up on the same rock bar. 100%. That's very likely to happen. But immediately, fish, once you move them, they do not
totally
go
agree.
Back.
I'm glad
because very, very, very seldom.
Because, Danny, we hear all sorts of great anglers say, we're going to come back on this spot during the major or at sundown and target that fish.
Yep. And not to say that fish – won't go back up on there.
Go ahead, Steve.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, that's a time. That's a time when they will go back up on structure. Is when a major change or a moon phase comes up. It takes some only a minute, 30 seconds a minute. It's amazing how fast they move back up on structure when they want to. Another thing being what Danny was just talking about, how they're not going back, I want to add something. That when I do go back to try a fish, because I still will, you know what I mean? I will still go back and try a fish if it was really hot. I still want to go back and try. But one thing I do, because of what I see on forward-facing sonar and side imaging, is yes, most of them do not go right back. But how fast they go out is another thing. If I go back fairly quick because that fish was really hot, I make sure my boat is way out from where it was when I first encountered that fish, so that I'm actually making longer casts to try to get up to the edge, but my bait is covering where my boat actually was before. And I'm actually probably another half a cast or a cast out, because some of those fish just go down, hang for a while, and then kind of mosey off on their way. And I've caught a lot of fish just making sure when I go back on a fish, I'm not expecting it to come right off that little nugget or right off that great little wee point, Steve, that it right. came off of.
Steve, I just want to touch base on you. You mentioned about the throwback, and Frank, you asked a question about
and it stayed out of ways.
Steve, like I remember said, on the boat with you.
Sometimes that's all the fire. Something go. Really sometimes they have right out all the way across the lake.
Maybe a follow or something, and you.
So
you talked about
that's
like
one thing I can tell you. When you go back on a fish
or a medusa up in the air and just smacking it down in the water to bring the attention of that.
If it's fish right is, away,
missed a strike or something to
if
come
you're going
back.
Right back on them. And, stay and out a lot farther than you did,
fish
than you were
the boat
when you first saw that fish.
Rod
and sometimes that will
it went after the lure, but it didn't strike or it didn't get caught, and then it just swam away really quickly. And I did exactly what you said, and I just chucked the lure really high in the air, and it came slapping down in the water, and I started reeling. And sure enough, I brought that fish back. But unfortunately, all the lines on the boat or the rods were on the boat, and I could not finish the sweep of the rod, and I didn't get a chance to bring it into a figure eight. But just the fact that I was able to bring that fish back was something that I learned from being on the boat with you, that's a possibility. Don't just because that fish swam away, don't think that it's gone immediately. Like you said, there's no time. Just do it right away, and you have a chance of bringing that fish back. So I just wanted to bring that up and say I tried it, and it worked.
Yeah, if I see a fish kind of leave a turn, you know, and heading out away from a turn, either sometimes faster, you can see that
Frank,
you
I
lost
have another
its
question,
interest
or you
on,
want, you want to go with
on the turn.
No, you go ahead.
it overshot the turn and it went
just
out.
Just while we're on this topic, you know, topic what I'll do of is technology, just, like, I want to ask another
six
question
or 10
about
feet
since,
a line off the end of my rod.
We
sweep
you,
the rod
Steve,
up high
and
down.
Danny, I don't
and
know
try
if we
and slap
up in
the
bait
on the water and pull the bait.
Is there anything
fast.
New
and if
that's
it
in your
happens
arsenal
to
now,
be
new
lucky
technology
enough
in terms of
that you got it near the face of that fish and you do that? I've had reactionary strikes like come out of nowhere and just smoke it. You know what I mean? It doesn't work all
rates,
the time.
Let's say for,
but it's a,
for example,
it's
we had discussions with Pete Mena and
opportunity
and the Livingston lure, the electronic
you know
bait
I mean?
Fish sound is something that's really important to him. He feels really strongly about how that the effect of that underwater and attracting fish. And just wondering if there's anything in your arsenal now that you hadn't you have not had previously, and it's something that's now integral to you going out on the water.
I mean, you know, other than I need a minute, Steve, go ahead. This one's on you.
I mean, maybe there's nothing, but go.
Go ahead, Danny. Well, if you talk to Pete about the – I mean, I think our understanding of the different lures and their effectivenesses in different areas of the water column. You know, I make it a big point when I'm fishing with people. Like if I have two other anglers or three other anglers, very seldom do I have any two people have the same bait on or even type of bait on unless there's something so overwhelmingly going on that you have to. Because I usually start my progression from the front of a boat with a very fast, very aggressive, kind of high running bait. And then as I move back towards the back end of the boat, I end up, you know, with a deep running type of a rubber bait or something. And in between, there might be a jerk bait. There might be a top. A lot of times, sometimes the very last bait through might be a topwater too, because sometimes, you know, a topwater after fish is followed deep from another bait and the bait is not, the boat's now 20, 10, 15 feet farther than it was. A topwater sometimes has a very triggered effect on a fish that followed another bait. But I try and go from
that
very
is so true.
High,
I think you just described
aggressive
me.
Baits and kind of down the spectrum
that's,
to maybe
that's 100%
a jerk bait
true
to
I mean
a crank bait,
well and I mean even
a
like
bait,
I'll even admit
like
and
that.
Like I know you told me back in the
so
day you need
to cover
you know
different
you only
parts
need
of
five baits to catch muskies
different part,
everybody used
different
to say right
of,
and like I remember
triggering
an old
fish
guy
activity
used to fish Lake of the Woods,
baits.
Bill Sandy.
And
he'd clip on
a
black and silver bucktail, and he'd take it off
kind of
at the start of the season, and he'd take it off in October.
It also kind of gives you a chance
and
to more thoroughly
can you catch
figure
fish
out
on
what the
one
fish
bait.
Really want.
Yes,
because
you
I'm
can.
Firm
and, I mean, ultimately, they can only bite what's
so
on the end of your line, right?
And what they want
but
fish to
by,
bite,
like Steve said, playing around. And it's not even just, you know, seasonally or monthly. It can be day to day what these fish are doing, right? And not even day to day, hour to hour at times, you know, especially like when you have like majors or, you know, the moon or a weather change rolling in, you know, those fish could go from 2 hours prior, you know, lazily following deep rubber baits to all of a sudden now they're on bucktails and topwater that, you know, this their activity level has changed. So that has to, you know, obviously kind of give you an idea of what to throw. The more aggressive the fish are going to be, you want to try and throw the bait you can move the fastest and effectively fish the best, right? With covering as much water to try and encounter when fish are being aggressive. Now, when the fish are being, you know, when you're in your doldrums of the day, that's when you kind of start to slow down, fish your more erratic style baits, like your jerk baits and your deeper rubber baits to try and trigger a bite, right? But when you have the conditions that these fish are starting to ramp up and be aggressive, that's when you can change to your, you know, your faster style baits and cover more water and hit more spots during those peak times.
How did a small town sheet metal mechanic come to build one of Canada's most iconic fishing lodges? I'm your host, Steve Nidzwicki, and you'll find out about that and a whole lot more on the Outdoor Journal Radio Network's newest podcast, Diaries of a Lodge Owner. But this podcast will be more than that. Every week on Diaries of a Lodge Owner, I'm going to introduce you to a ton of great people, share their stories of our trials, tribulations, and inspirations. Learn and have plenty of laughs along the way.
Meanwhile, we're sitting there bobbing along, trying to figure out how to catch a bass. And we both decided one day we were going to be on television doing a fishing show.
My hands get sore a little bit when I'm reeling in all those bass in the summertime, but that's might be for more fishing than it was punching.
You so confidently you said, "Hey, Pat, have you ever eaten a drum?"
Find Diaries of a Lodge Owner now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear from bait casting to fly fishing, and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top quality service. But Izoco's more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips, swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories. No matter what species you love to target, from boot to headlamp, Angling Sports has what you need. Their store is massive, and it's just loaded with equipment and apparel. So if you love to go after those big toothy critters like we do, it's a one-stop shop for all pike and musky tackle. Whether you're looking for trolling rods or casting reels, Angling Sports is always adding the latest and best industry offerings from entry level to higher end. Looking for custom musky baits? They got them. It's worth the drive to London. So check out their amazing store in person or online by visiting anglingsports.ca and net that PB in style.
Well, really, really good tips, Frank. Like everything that's being said, I'm just doing mental notes.
I'm recalling our trips up there because Chris, And Steve and Danny, I remember a long time ago going up there and everyone was like, cranberry's the color. Cranberries. I don't know if it was the week or if
it was black and smoke for us, Frank. Well, when I was there, black and smoke.
I'm getting there. And that's part of it. Like, and I wasn't sure if it was the week or the year or whatever. And then Chris and I went back and it was, black and smoke. I think black and smoke is, maybe I'm misspeaking, but I think that's probably a consistent winner up at Eagle Lake, I would think. But I was impressed at how everyone was on the same page and were dialed into the colors that were working. And I was also impressed by how everybody was sharing information. And this was one of my first experiences at it. This is my second experience at one of the great Canadian musky lodges. And I walked in and of course, Steve, I didn't know your name was Steve. I thought your name was Herbie. And I'm like, I want to talk to Herbie. And someone said, well, Steve's over there. And I'm like, well, I don't want to talk to Steve. And so I go over to Steve at the freaking table. And I'm like, hey, Steve, you know, and I put my map down and I said, can you show me where to catch a muskie? And someone, one of the other guides had showed me an area where the walleye, where it was good for walleye. And you pointed there and I said, well, that's where the walleye are. And you looked at me and you nodded. And now that I'm a little more familiar with the lake, it was, you know, when you come down straight south, straight shot out of Vermilion Bay, you pass Boat Island, you keep going, and then you can make a left-hand turn and there's that alley of big rock cliffs before you get, I think, kind of where Martin Luther is over there. That big rock face, it was right there. And of course, that's the only place I've ever caught a muskie on Eagle Lake, Steve. So I got to thank you for that. Almost by accident, but I caught a muskie there. But it just goes to show that I think the culture up where you guys are and the people that you guys are, it's a real wonderful place. It's a magical place. And like every other great place and culture on anything you do, be it a fishery or a jiu-jitsu gym like I run, it's all about the people. And the willingness to share information there and for everyone to work together is a really special thing. So hats off to you guys.
Well, you know, and at the end of the day, that's how we make our living, right?
Yeah.
Is by having people come up and fulfill their dreams, right? A lot of times for, you know, a guy that I fish with, it's been his life goal to catch a big muskie or, you know, catch a big walleye or whatever it may be. And when it boils down to it, you know, by us sharing what's going on, not just with, you know, the guys at the camp, but other guides, because, you know, I may fish with him one day and he may be with a different guide another day. Well, if that other guide is clued in to kind of what's going on or what I've had success with, ultimately it's going to make his trip better too, right? So by us all working together and sharing our knowledge, at the end of the day, everybody benefits from it, right? You know, it's just, you know, we all got each other's backs. And, you know, at the end of the day, if I'm struggling, I expect the same from somebody else, right? So it's if I scratch your back, you know, you scratch mine type of deal, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, not necessarily spots or anything, just patterns. Because we all know the lake good enough to work a pattern if something pops up on somebody else's radar that's working. And another thing, too. You know, when you take people out and you have a different attitude with them, as much as an educator as you are trying to catch a fish, it's like the old saying, you know, you teach a man how to fish, you feed him forever. You know, well, it's kind of the same way with musky fishing in that if you try to educate an angler through the course of the day why you're doing this. Why, God, I don't give a shit, you know, as well as I do. Nobody's going to catch a muskie every single day. I don't care how good they are. There's some days God couldn't catch a fish. But if you teach a person through a tough day on why you're doing what, I mean, I've had people tell me that they learned way more on a day we never caught a fish that they could use the rest of their life and then call me and tell me and make me feel great about how they caught a big fish because of what they learned that day. It makes what you do fulfilling too, you know? So that's what we try to do each and every day is try to teach a person the fundamentals of everything from casting to figure eight. Even the best anglers sometimes aren't doing some things right, that just little adjustments, you know, they go on another trip and it makes the whole difference for them. And, you know, real anglers, rather than buying a fish, are buying the total experience. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Well, when you have a life like Danny, you're a full-time guide, Steve, your journey from Wisconsin to Eagle Lake and just like a life pursuit of these elusive giants, like, is that what keeps you going? Is that what gets you up every day? The fact that you're able to translate your knowledge and help people succeed in this sport. And I'll never forget, Steve, you mentioned to us that, you know, when you see a big fish, if your knees don't knock, or if you don't get a little nervous, you're going to hang up the rod, because like even after seeing so many huge fish and catching so many fish, you still have that child bug of, you know, that innocence of like, oh my God, it's a big fish. You get nervous, you get scared. And that's something that never goes away with the people who just have that lifelong passion. So like, you know, but you're doing it every day for how many, 30, 40 years, and your son now is on the same path. So between the two of you, is that what keeps you going? It's just that love of translating that to the client?
100%.
Yeah, most definitely. Plus, it keeps me out of trouble. Helps keep me out of trouble too.
At
the end of the day, I mean, it is a job, yes, but I'm very, very fortunate that I am one that I can say I love my job. I took my passion and created it my job. Now that's a double-edged sword, but you know, to see the excitement and the enthusiasm when somebody catches, you know, maybe a big muskie, maybe their first muskie, maybe anything, you know, that's what makes it all worth it. And all the days that you get zeroed or, you know, you're just having rough days, those all go away when that happens, right? I get lucky and I catch some big fish here and there.
Look at your Instagram account.
Is it the same if I catch it versus like a client? I'd rather 100%. I'd rather have my client catch the fish. It means more to me to have somebody catch that fish other than myself. I'm not out there every day fishing for myself. I'm out there every day fishing for you. You know what I mean? And I want, my end goal is for you to have the best, come away with the best experience and catch, you know, potentially the biggest fish or your first fish or whatever your goal may be.
Chris, go into your question, then we'll ask these gentlemen for a fish story and get them on their merry way, because man, this has been a great discussion, but we don't want to take up all their time. So what do you got?
Yeah, I think my question leads into a story. I think before that, we should just discuss, like, when people want to reach out to Steve and Danny to book them, what's the best possible way just to contact Andy Myers Lodge and book you directly, call you directly, like, do you have personal guide services to contact you directly through Facebook, or maybe speak a bit about how people can get in touch with you?
I can be reached anytime by just going online and looking up Steve Herbeck Fishing. All my information is there. Or message me on my Facebook page. You know, I'm also half the season I'm in Wisconsin. If you're a listener from, you know, south of the border, and then half the season I'm up on Eagle Lake. Both of us can at any time be reached, you know, through Julian at Andy Myers Lodge. But we always like to make it personable and talk with people we're going to spend time with in the boat. At least I do anyway. So I can be reached anytime on my website, you know, Steve Herbeck Fishing, or my Facebook at Steve Herbeck. So I'm pretty easy to find.
Yeah. And I mean, if anybody's looking, you know, if anybody's looking to get a hold of me, you know, I have an Instagram and Facebook, Danny Herbeck. And I mean, if you are looking to, you know, come up to Eagle and fish, you know, by all means, get in touch with me. And, you know, I can facilitate, you know, walking you through the steps and getting everything put through for you to stay potentially at Andy Myers Lodge. If that's your end destination that you're looking at staying. Or just, you know, you're coming up and, you know, you're looking for a little info to kind of shorten the learning curve. You know, I'm always willing to help out if anybody, you know, needs any advice, in that regard. So, like I said, I'm always around and feel free to reach out.
Yeah. What he was just saying, you know, I mean, it's been our lives since Danny was 12 and for me, the last 40 years. And, you know, it's the same way as when we're guiding. It doesn't bother me one bit. You'd be surprised how many people from over in your area, guys, have called me just to ask me about, you know, what they would do in this situation, or what should they use and stuff like that. Canadians even, not less, you know, the Americans. That so don't be afraid to call at least me, and I'm sure Danny's the same way. You're not bothering us. Fishing is our living, and we certainly like helping people. And so if you got some questions on a certain fishery you're going to, or what might help you, or something like that, or besides just booking a fishing trip, don't be afraid to get a hold of us at any time.
Very generous.
Very generous.
I tried right, that with my lawyer. They don't have the same.
Yeah, I should start charging $100 a minute or $100 an hour for Musky info. Maybe I'll get somewhere in life.
Just get an OnlyFans page, Danny. What do you? It's 2024. Come on, get with the times.
Oh man.
So awesome. I have to ask this question while I have you both on, and I think Frank, you probably have something similar, and I think this could lead into a story, a link story or individual stories. But I mean, there must be hundreds of these stories, or out like hours and time on water that you've spent together. And there's obviously something special about being in the boat with your father and son, and just sitting there alone, casting for muskie on this majestic world class waters of Eagle Lake. So, and then on top of that all, you're catching muskie together. So I'm just curious if there's any special standout moments or something you'd like to share with us about just you two being alone in the boat together. And obviously it's a lifelong, almost genetic passion that like genetic inside you. And it's a passion that's taken over your life. So just curious if there's something that you could share with us about that.
What a great question.
The day that sticks out to me, which wasn't like when I was necessarily young that, made me a musky nut or drove my passion for musky fishing, was, the separation of COVID, right? Steve was stuck down there. I was stuck up here, for almost 2 years. And, other than, maintaining phone conversations and that, I never got to see my father for 2 years. And then finally borders did open, and, you came up, what was that, second week of August or no, September. Remember when, you came up and just fished for like 3-4 days.
Right. Yeah. The border had only been open about a week or two.
And, camp was busy, but, we weren't, a lot of people had canceled trips and, so I had an afternoon, I think, is all I had. And, I said, Steve, let's get out there and get after it, and, see if we still got it, let's see if we can make something happen type deal. And it was just, one of those, we didn't plan the weather. We didn't plan the trip. It was just one of those days where the weather was kind of coming in. Cause remember we actually, when we left the dock, we're like, why are we even wasting our time? Remember it was flat, calm, like 85 degrees, not a cloud in the sky. Mm-hmm. And we went and we fished like two spots and nothing was happening. And then all of a sudden you could, the front was rolling in and you could see it and it was coming and coming and coming and the wind picked up and it was just like a magical afternoon of fishing. We went four spots and caught seven fish up to 53 inches, just, wow. out of nowhere. And, Steve's running the boat. I'd catch a fish. I'd run the boat. Steve would catch a fish. It was just like, one of those days that, it was like making up for all the hardships, of not being able to, to see my dad and, spend time with him and all that. It was truly a day I'll actually never forget.
Great story.
Love it.
Yeah. The other one was, I think the year before COVID, and I stayed an extra few days and you were actually done fishing and doing your deer hunts. And I was about ready to leave the next day and talked Julian into going out, and you had gotten your scouting done, and we took off. I took off with Julian in the dark, and we picked you up just as the sun was peeking over, and you jumped in the boat, and I don't think we went 20 feet, and you caught a 52-incher. By the end of the day, we had eight or nine fish and lost three or four more, and it was a great way to end the season for me. And again, those were two of the few times that we've gotten to spend time in the boat together because we're both so busy doing what we do, you know. And then another was when we took young Dax, grandson Dax, out last year. And Dax, he's 6 years old, got a 53-incher. I had to hold his belt so he wouldn't get pulled over the side. He had his knees stuck against the side of the boat, and he was just a wrangling that thing. And Danny got the fish in the net, and I ain't seen Danny shake that hard since he was about 8 years old and shot his first deer. It was crazy.
I got really good video of that. The unedited video is quite comical. If you could imagine two Herbecks in the boat with Dax fighting that giant muskie. Oh, that was, I'll never forget that. Not only just because I got to spend it with you, but to see my son, you know, catch his first muskie, and it to be a fish of that caliber was something, you know. I kind of set the poor kid up for failure, actually, but we'll see how he rebounds after that.
That was a great question, Chris, and you know, I think a lot of our listeners are reliving these special moments with our fathers that we got to, you know, some of us a long time ago, and some of us not too long time ago. So that's that was wonderful. Those were great stories, and. Thank you, guys. Guys, I'm going to sign us off. Before we go, Danny and Steve, is there anything else you want to mention?
No, that I just appreciate you guys, you know, taking time out of your day and talking muskies.
Yeah, it's been great touching base with you. And is that right? I understand that you guys are kind of in the beer business too now?
Not only are we in the beer business, we are also in the meat business. So Chris and I, we just launched at the Muskie Odyssey that just happened. We just launched grass-fed beef pepperettes, no steroids, no hormones, no antibiotics, clean meat fuel, great snacks for anglers and hunters in the field. And that's what we launched with our beer, Steve. So both products in May will hit the market.
Well, I'll tell you where I was going with that, you guys pack some of that stuff up and get back to Andy Myers Lodge, and we'll do some bartering on fishing bait.
That's a great proposal.
Don't tempt us with a good time. I think that's definitely doable. Definitely doable, Steve. And you know, Chris and I enjoyed so much our time fishing with you. And like I said at the beginning of the broadcast, one of our favorite in-person episodes, just, you know, listeners, go back and find Steve Herbeck, man. That's got to be in the 20s or even earlier. I can't remember in terms of the number of our episodes, but it is an amazing talk, and just the emotion. I'll never forget the seriousness and the passion that came from you. It affected Chris and I. It affected the show. It affected the benchmark for interviews and for fishing trips that we tried to take in subsequent years. So I can't imagine it won't be too long before we're back up at Eagle Lake. And Steve, we would never go back there without, you know, coordinating with you and making sure you had time with us. So we will bring the beer. All right. Chris. Yes, sir. You got it. What an amazing time. We want to thank the listeners for hanging in. And you know what? Leave a review for us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. That would really help the show. And you know what? Email us or send us a message through social media if you are anybody who works in the fishing industry. We have a deck for you to consider for sponsorship. As the listeners can tell, we have sponsors approaching us now, quite a few. And with our impressions per month, we are getting massive listenership for the show. And we also have an international TV component now that we have sponsored the Get In There segment of the Fishing Canada TV show. Podcast rates for TV exposure. There's nothing like it in the industry. So get in touch with us. Even if you're a small one-man operation, we have a la carte options for everybody. And our sponsors are very happy, as I learned this weekend at the Muskie Odyssey. So please look us up. Until next time, guys, we are signing off. Thanks for hanging in there and enjoying this time with two legends of the game. Take care.
Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear from bait casting to fly fishing and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top-quality service. But Izoco is more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips, swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories.
Hi, everybody. I'm Angelo Viola.
And I'm Pete Bowman.
Now, you might know us as the hosts of Canada's favorite fishing show, but now we're hosting a podcast.
That's right. Every Thursday, Ange and I will be right here in your ears, bringing you a brand new episode of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Now, what are we going to talk about for 2 hours every week?
Well, you know there's going to be a lot of fishing.
I knew exactly where those fish were going to be and how to catch them, and they were easy to catch.
Yeah, but it's not just a fishing show. We're going to be talking to people from all facets of the outdoors, from athletes.
All the other guys would go golfing. Me and Garth and Turk and all the Russians would go fishing.
To scientists.
But now that we're reforesting and letting things free, it's the perfect transmission environment for Lyme disease.
To chefs.
If any game isn't cooked properly,
marinated,
or you will taste it.
And whoever else will pick up the phone.
Wherever you are, Outdoor Journal Radio seeks to answer the questions and tell the stories of all those who enjoy being outside.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you know the name of Canada's one and only specialized pike and muskie shop? It's Izoco, and it's an Esox angler's paradise, offering the very best in hand-picked, top-quality gear from bait casting to fly fishing and even specialized Scandinavian tackle. Izoco's staff will provide expert advice and top-quality service. But Izoco is more than just a store. It's a community of passionate anglers that make up the Izoco tribe, and they're always ready to share tips, swap stories. So head over to their shop in person or online at izocofishing.com and let Izoco turn those fishing trips into epic stories.